Boy, I got my work cut out for me this morning, don't I? Tough issues. And the deal about what we deal with the question of the problem of evil and suffering is that every one of us have had situations in life where we've looked at this and go, okay, I believe. Or maybe we're struggling and we're skeptics and we're not sure if we believe. That in the midst of that, the struggle with people suffering, whether it's our own family members or even when we watch it on TV, it leaves us in a place where we're not quite sure what to do with it, because it's hard to reconcile the idea of a God who is good, a God who is all-powerful, and the fact that evil exists. In fact, that's kind of always the three-pronged, stool of the issue. It's like one of those things can't be true. Either evil doesn't exist, and we know it does. Suffering is a part of reality. Or God can't be good, or he can't solve the problem. He's good, but he's not strong enough to deal with it. And when those questions come up in our own lives, or even in the lives of people who are around us, and they raise a question, it becomes a very hard thing to answer. Sometimes, as Christians, we say something that's true, but it feels insufficient, which is, well, God has a purpose for it. We don't know how to answer that purpose, but God has a purpose. And I'm not denying that's a true statement. I think it is. But sometimes when you see just the kind of suffering and the hugeness of it, the vastness of it, I don't know. For me, it's a point of massive tension. You've heard me talk about going to Haiti, driving through Haiti. Well, God has a purpose for it. Just somehow, some way, shape, or form feels insufficient when I look at just the fact that mile after mile, street after street, place after place, it's just brutal and broken. Last night I was, I'm one of these weird guys. I'm a night owl, and it's hard for me to unwind and go to sleep at night. And so Heidi, rolls over and goes to sleep, and then I turn on the TV. And normally I'm watching something like Seinfeld, something that's just kind of keep me light, and I'll get to the point where I'm tired. I turn off TV and go to sleep, because if I don't, my mind starts pondering these big questions, And then once I get fixated on it, I'm like, up for another 2 hours and got to turn on another episode of Seinfeld. So last night I'm sitting there flipping through, and I've never actually seen the whole movie, but I just saw about 5 minutes of the movie We Are Soldiers. It's a Mel Gibson film. And in the just few minutes I saw, the horrors of war, and the part I saw, this guy, literally he gets blown up, but he doesn't die. And I mean, what he's going through and how they depict it on the screen, just massive. And my tendency is to run from that and run back to a comedy or something where I can laugh. I don't like dealing with that. I really don't like going to movies where this is a reality. I'm not going to run to go see movies like Schindler's List or, other stuff that's out there. I'm not a big war movie fan, and this is part of the reason I get really kind of sometimes shaken and deeply bothered by people who are hurting and in massive pain. And you start reading the Bible, and you're like, okay, we've got to be able to find an answer. Isn't there a chapter and verse where it says, well, people suffer, there's evil in the world, it's this broken because... And like, there's like a paragraph that just lays it out. A lot of people think there's a book of the Bible that a lot of people go to this book of Bible thinking they'll get the answer. It's the book of Job. And if you're familiar with the story of Job, the basic story is that Job's a good guy. He honors God. He loves the Lord. And Satan has a conversation with God and goes, well, the only reason he loves you is because you take care of him. You hook him up. He's all good, And Satan says this to God, and God says, well, let's see, take it all from him. And basically, God allows Satan to just wreck his life. He loses his family, he loses all of his wealth, and he loses his health just like that. And by the end of chapter 2, Job is sitting in an ash heap with a little knife, picking at the sores on his body, just in absolute despair. And you think, okay, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to read the book of Job. I'm going to get to the end. And the punchline of Job is God's going to stand up and go, by the way, Job, this is why I did this. And if you read the book of Job to find out the answer to the question, why does God allow suffering, or why do good people suffer? You get to the end of the book of Job and you're frustrated because the Bible doesn't answer that. Actually, at the end of the book of Job, God just goes, okay, I'm God. And I'm sovereign, and Job, you weren't here when I laid out the world. You cannot know the eternal counsel of God. But boy, it's sometimes really hard for us to come to that conclusion and be okay with it, isn't it? And so today, as we tackle this issue, I just got to tell you that I don't know that I'm going to come to a good, tightly wound philosophical conclusion to that question. But this is what I want to challenge you with, okay? This is what I want to say to you as people that are part of Genesis, some of you going through suffering right now, that ultimately the beauty of the gospel and the beauty of Christianity, while it may not give us complete answers, and I think the Bible does give us answers to these questions, but while it doesn't just nice, neat little package answer this question, Christianity gives us the absolutely best resources in life to deal with it, for us to interact with the brokenness and the suffering and the pain of ourselves and other people. And even this morning, there's some of us here that this is a philosophical question, meaning we interact with it. Somebody says, where were you on September 11th? And you can remember right the point you were as you dealt with the horror of what humanity could do with humanity. You remember watching the stories of Hurricane Katrina as nature just absolutely devastated a coast, or even worse than that, the tsunami that hit Southeast Asia a couple years ago, and how 250,000 people just like that, woke up and life was fine, and next thing you know, they were hit and they drowned. Just horrible stuff. You have watched on TV and you're flipping through late night and you see the starving kids in Africa and you got shaken by that. But it's kind of for us something, sometimes it's more of a philosophical. I see it and it's hard for me to reconcile, but it's not personal. But for many of you in this room, the question of suffering and brokenness and twistedness is a very personal issue because in very deep ways, you've experienced very difficult stages of life and suffering, or watched a loved one really struggle and go through deep pain, or had somebody lose a child way too early. And the brokenness of life has become very obvious, okay? And, when it's more personal than philosophical. I could sit up here and spout out philosophical answers all morning. I could explain philosophically how the Bible kind of interacts with this. But what I really want to do is I want to come to more of the personal and tell you that in Christ, and in the incarnation, in God leaving the glory of heaven and stepping into this earth and taking on humanity and then going through a suffering, what God has done for us is given us in Christ the best resource, the best way, place for us to go, the best way for us to interact with the hardship and brokenness of suffering, okay? So truth is, kind of heavy topic, kind of hard. For some of us, like I said, it's hard. Some of us suffering is, I don't drive an SUV like my neighbors, or my mom and dad won't buy me Abercrombie clothes, or the girl at my lunch table makes fun of me, or I know one person here, it's like, the epitome of suffering is snakes. And when a snake gets in your house, you just melt down. That happens, that's suffering. That happened, by the way, for us this week. We had a snake in the house and we suffered. It was deeply intense. And the question of why, God, would you allow this was all over our house for a few minutes. How do you interact with this, and how does the gospel deal with this? And just to kind of prime the pump, I want to kind of interact with, okay, here's the problem of evil and suffering. We're sitting here this morning and not one of us would really deny that it's real, right? Is there anybody who goes, I don't think suffering really happens because my life is perfect and I don't have any issues of suffering? No, we wake up and we're hurting, and especially as we get older, our backs and our legs and our bodies hurt more. But then we interact with it. We see people who have terminal illnesses. We read stories. Reading a story this week about a family in central Missouri whose child has this disease. He's like three, four years old and has this disease where every time the child gets a bruise, what his body does is his body turns the bruise into bone. And a little bit at a time, this boy is just being becoming calcified, and they know that the kid isn't going to live that long. But it's massively painful. How do you deal with that? We know it's real. And yes, we want to ask God. I mean, if we were to say, if you could sit down and ask God one question, a large percent of us would somehow frame the question of evil and suffering. But let's just talk about what do other systems do? Because I think what I'm trying to say is when we're confronted with this, whether it's by a friend or it's in culture or it's in our own lives, the answer is when we come to the incarnation, the gospel. There is in this the best resources for dealing with it. And so if it's personal, not just philosophical, but when it's personal for you, we have a place to go and to find great hope and joy in the midst of it, okay? And so other systems ask, deal and ask and answer the question different ways. For example, in Buddhism, people tell me I have the body of a god, Buddha. In Buddhism, some of you will get that about noon today. Basically, what Buddhism says is that suffering is an illusion that is created by our attachment to the physical world. That literally what needs to happen is we need to enter this state where we are freed from the physical and we experience this point of enlightenment where we're released from. And our suffering is this, the problem is that we're too attached to the physical real world. And suffering is kind of, and they don't even really believe in God. They don't quite know what to call it, but suffering is the universe's way, if you want to say that, from pushing us into a spiritual state of existence where we're freed from the binding of the spiritual, the physical world. And it's just an illusion because the physical world isn't real. And so it's really, I mean, in a way, any suffering you go through is really just something that is created in your mind as a way to free yourself. That doesn't work because there are times where you really hurt and where both in your heart but also in your body, it's very real. Hinduism is going to tell us that suffering is a result of bad karma, that you had a previous life, and if you really suffer poorly in the previous life, that means you were just a no-good scoundrel who made a mess of your life and didn't use the opportunities, and so now you're working off your bad karma. And this is why if you go to India, like Satan, I believe, is a real being with real personality and really, it's not just some weird personification of evil, that he has schemes. Karma, I mean, you know, in our culture, karma's kind of laughed at and toyed with and exalted, and there's a whole show that's one of the top comedies on TV that is all around this guy trying to work off his bad karma. Karma is one of the worst tricks Satan played on the human race. And people exalt the Hindu, this Eastern idea of religion, and it's really gaining popularity in America. But what goes on is when you really see the outcome of that and you go to a place like India and you see the people on the streets who are, I mean, they're beggars and they're in deep suffering. And India is actually one of the wealthiest nations in the world. Massive amounts of resources. But because they believe those people are working off their karma, nobody who has a quote-unquote good life will ever do anything for anybody who's in the streets and living in brokenness. And people over there will do things like if they're born in poverty and they have kids, they will literally take their children, do things like break their arms or cut their arms off to make this life the worst it possibly can be so they can absolutely work off all the bad karma so the next time around it's better. I don't know, it doesn't work for me. That's so sad. Islam basically says suffering is God's will, his way of getting you under his thumb and forcing you into submission. And so suffering to them is ultimately a good thing because suffering is God imposing his will on you and forcing you to submit. And then the real one, atheism, because a lot of people who will challenge Christianity with the question of how can a good God allow evil and suffering? And what's really funny, and here's just a moment of the philosophical deal, that's a really funny question coming from somebody who doesn't believe in God because the idea of evil and good are not really capable in an atheistic framework. Because ultimately, if you're really going to be honest as an agnostic or an atheist, you have to say that good and bad are just something that comes from my own experience, but that the highest quote-unquote good for an atheist is the survival of the fittest. And so when a tsunami wipes out 250,000 people, that is nature's way of weeding out some of the weaker people. And I mean, nobody wants to hear anybody say that for real because it sounds so harsh. But the atheistic system who says it's evolutionary, they have to say survival of the fittest is the highest moral, right? And the outcome of that is that if people suffer and die, it's a good thing because the strongest will survive. Now, you'll never hear anybody articulate that, but make no bones about it. When people are standing up and saying, we want to deny God in our culture, and we're going to teach atheistic evolution in our classrooms, and we're going to make that the center pin of our existence, and then they say questions like, well, how can God be good? They are in a category that they have no right talking about. Good does not exist. Because the only way you have good is if you have something that's the foundation for good, which we would say God is the basis of what is good and evil. And to me, man, the atheistic response to this, while people may be moved with some compassion, try to put their arms around you, the real philosophical response of any atheistic system is, but if you die and go away, that's probably a good thing for a culture. Now, they'll never say that. But that's really at the heart of the system. And what happens in Christianity, while we struggle with, okay, God, you are good. We believe that. The Bible's clear. You're a righteous, holy, just God. And you are all powerful. But we look around and we see the brokenness and the deep pain people have. And sometimes we don't know how to answer that question. But in the midst of this, we come to the reality that God has not separated himself from it, but he has come in the person of Christ and has entered into our suffering with us, okay? And that's the framework, that's the strength of the gospel, that we're not left alone, that we do get answers from God, but more than that, we get God. We get God in the midst of our suffering, and he will become in us in those times a great source of beauty and hope and joy, even in the midst of it. And this is why when you start reading the Bible and you start reading history, you run into people like Joseph. Story of Joseph goes something like this. Joseph, I mean, he's a pretty good guy, good family, dad loves him, gives him the best, but his brothers despise him, and so his brothers, kind of strip him of all of his goods, throw him in a hole, and then sell him to a band of gypsies. He is then taken a long way away from home. He's sold into slavery, and he ends up in Egypt working in this guy's house, this guy named Potiphar. While he's working in this guy named Potiphar's house, he's just still trying to honor God and be what God has called him to be, and he doesn't sin, he doesn't mess up, he's just trying to bless the place he's at. Joseph was gifted by God with incredible organizational skills. Joseph hears God speak through dreams. But while he's in this home serving this family as a slave and just really trying to say, you know, I'm going to do this to honor God, the wife in the family begins to look at Joseph and think he's, you know, hot to trot and good looking, and she starts thinking, I want some of that, and starts flirting with him, and Joseph won't have anything to do with it, and she keeps coming on, finally corners him one day and basically says, my husband's gone, nobody will know, you and me, right now, it will be a good time. And Joseph's response is to flee, but she grabs him as he's fleeing and literally rips his clothes off as he's leaving the room. And then as a result, she begins to claim rape. His goodness leads to this false accusation. He gets thrown in prison. He's left there. A lot of other situations happen, but the bottom line is David's life, while he is every step of the way doing everything he can to honor God, to have faith, every decision he makes to honor God ends up taking him to a place where it is hurt, it is broken, it is hard. Eventually, his brothers who sold him into slavery come back into his life. Long story short, eventually Joseph reveals himself to these brothers and shows love to him. By the time we get to this point of the story of Joseph, Joseph has actually been exalted to a place of great power in Egypt through a lot of other events. But he loves on his brother, he cares for him. Instead of, you know, saying, I'm going to get vengeance, he shows mercy, he shows compassion, he shows grace. And finally, they confront him and go, why? Why did you do this? And Joseph's response is, listen, you meant it for evil, but God meant the whole thing for good. And his purpose was to accomplish something much bigger than just us, guys. What you meant for evil, God meant for good. And what you see is you study the Bible and then you get into studying Christianity. You find these people who hit points where life just is horrible and it's broken. And they have horrible diseases, or they are massively persecuted, or they die horrible, painful deaths for the cause of Christ. And in the midst of this, these people who are suffering have ridiculous joy, and they hold on to Jesus with a passion that just doesn't make sense. And the question is, what is it in Christianity in the midst of suffering? Because C.S. Lewis said that God whispers in our victories, but he shouts in our adversities and pains. What is it in this system? What is it in the gospel that gives us the resources to face the brokenness? And so if you're here this morning and you're like, I'm in the middle of it, I want to take you right to Jesus and show you how his suffering gives us a place to go. And if you're not, it's more of a philosophical question, because at this point in time in life, everybody's got hardships, but you're like, for real, it's not that bad. You can point people to Jesus, but you can also hold on to this for the day where it will come, because we will all face some point in time a bad doctor's report, a massive betrayal by a friend, persecute, whatever it looks like. And how do we go to that? And so I want to take you to a passage in the book of Isaiah. I'm actually going to read an entire chapter this morning, Isaiah chapter 53. So if you have your Bibles, turn there. We're going to look at that. It's on page 519 in our Bibles. If you don't have a Bible, pass one down so everybody has one. We'll be on page 519 in that Bible. We're going to read this entire chapter as this guy named Isaiah, who was one of God's prophets. He was one of God's spokesmen. He's actually speaking into the nation of Israel's history about 700 years before Jesus. But he talks about Jesus in incredible clarity, and very specifically the suffering of Jesus, how Jesus steps into flesh and becomes a human being, and what he did for us in Isaiah 53. And it's just an incredible passage helping us see what Christ accomplished in his coming. So Isaiah 53, and I'll just begin with verse 1. Like I said, I'm just going to read the entire chapter. So just read along with me, okay? It says, who has believed what they heard from us, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up like a young plant and like a root out of the dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Now here's one thing, just as we go through this, I want you to feel what Isaiah's trying to picture. And whatever the suffering that you struggle with, whether it's personal or philosophical, I want you to notice in the language of this that Jesus experienced every level. He says, he just said, he was just despised and rejected. He was a man of sorrows. He was acquainted with grief. I mean, he was ditched by his friends, abused by the cultures, experienced deep heartache. And he was one from whom men hide their faces. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he's borne our griefs and our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his stripes we are healed. In other words, what he says here is the physical anguish that Jesus went through will match anything anybody's ever experienced. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one of us to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed, he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth, meaning he was treated unjustly and inhumanely. Like a lamb that was led to the slaughter, and like sheep that are before shears are silent, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgressions of my people? In other words, Jesus' experience was just disregarded. There was no Fox and CNN, and you know, there was no news corporation that showed up and went, this Jesus guy, man, what's going on with him is wrong. They just didn't care. And they made his grave with the wicked, but a rich and with a rich man in his death, although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. In other words, in all of this, Jesus lived with the reality that this is God's will for him. When his soul makes an offering for sin, he shall see his offspring. He will prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper his land. Out of the anguish of his soul, he will see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear the iniquities. Therefore, I will divide him a portion with many, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong. And because he has poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors, yet he bore the sin of many and makes intercession for the transgressors. What Isaiah does is he gives us in this passage a place to go to realize that God interacts with our suffering. He does not leave us alone. And there's just kind of three things or three tools out of this passage that I think, like I said, I think in the midst of looking at suffering as a reality in life, three tools kind of out of this passage that we can run to and we can apply to any situation in life that will give us the resources to interact and deal with suffering, okay? And the first one is this. The first resource is that Jesus, in this passage, it tells us that he suffered for us. That Jesus, literally the suffering was for us, that he was bruised for our transgressions, that he was crushed for our iniquities, that Jesus suffered for us. At the core of biblical theology, at the core, the heart of the gospel, is that you and I are broken, twisted people living in a broken, twisted world, and we need redemption. And people say, what do we need to be saved from? I mean, people say, have you been saved? You know, it's kind of one of the things every once in a while you're here, that you need salvation. Well, from what? And really at the heart of it, the biblical answer is that I need to be saved from me. There's a guy named G.K. Chesterton who was an author. He was a contemporary of C.S. Lewis and a friend of C.S. Lewis, and he was a Christian and a very well-known person of thought in London in the early to mid-1900s. And the London newspaper, the big London newspaper wrote this big story, and the question was, what is wrong with the world? And in the thing, they actually asked people to write in letters to the editor to give their thoughts of what is wrong with the world. And G.K. Chesterton sent in a response to the letter of the editor. And it's amazing. It was a two-word response, three letters, and his name. What is wrong with the world? His response that got printed in the London newspaper was, I am. Sincerely, G.K. Chesterton. I mean, see, at the heart of the issue is that we are broken and twisted. People say, well, why doesn't God just do away with evil? And here's the answer. If he did, he would have to do away with me. That a large portion of the brokenness and twist in the world is God's actual loving response to the fact that I want a world without God. I want Disney World without Walt Disney, okay? I want a beautiful, perfect place that has all the perks without the creator. And the world is broken and twisted as this reminder that every day we look at, wake up and read the newspaper, every day we interact with the struggles, every day I feel pain in my life, something ought to be going off in me going, this is not the way it's supposed to be. This is not the way it should be happening. When we cry out and say, God, why do you allow evil and suffering? Something on the inside of us is at the moment we ask that question going, this world isn't the way it's supposed to be. At the same time, infinite beauty and infinite pain, right? I mean, we drive around this time of year, we look at the trees and we're wowed at the beauty. And at the same time, there is this infinite amount of suffering and brokenness in this world. And we go, I see in the beauty of creation, I look into my children's eyes and I see that the wow factor of this place. And then at the same moment, I feel the deep brokenness and the conflict between those two things just doesn't resonate. And we go, this is not the way it should be. And the story of the gospel is this. God agrees. This is not the way it should be. Now, he is sovereign. It's not that something's outside of his control. But he created us, and he gave us the opportunity to live for his glory or to live for our own. We chose to live for our own, and brokenness entered into the world, and the world's twisted and messed up, but it still has the imprint of the beauty of its creator. But God didn't leave this world to itself either. He didn't just say, okay, you made your bed, now you live in it. He did not become a God who said, I'm going to keep my distance. I'm not going to be touched by your messed up lives. But rather, the beauty of the story of the cross and the gospel and the story of Jesus is that God stepped out of heaven, his place of privilege, his throne, and he stepped in. And this is why you start reading the life of Jesus and you're like, this is God? I mean, Jesus is born in a little bitty redneck village. I tease my classes when I teach at Missouri Baptist University. I talk to them about, you know, if you were to compare where was Jesus born, compare it here, you know, we'd think Jesus would be born in Ladue or at St. John's Hospital, but what if Jesus was born in Dittmer? And I like making fun of Dittmer because my friend Brian's from Dittmer. There's like a Dittmer-Catawissa Road. Have you ever been on it? You drive on the Dittmer-Catawissa Road and you don't pass Dittmer or Catawissa. I never understood that. Until I realized that Dittmer's a gas station, Catawissa is one house. And then I was like, okay, I guess it makes sense. Jesus is born in this little redneck village, and when his earthly parents show up, they can't even find a place to stay. And so Jesus' first bed is a feeding trough. I mean, seriously, what would happen? You know, some of you, I mean, we have these two beautiful babies, and some of you have these incredible babies. What would happen if you were in a situation where your babies were born and the only option you have was to put them in a feeding trough? I mean, like the cows are eating around your baby. And that's how the story starts. And it goes downhill from there. The culture was against him. People hated him. He had this trend of people would follow him and then they would ditch him. Even his closest friends ran from him in his greatest hour of need. They took him, and in the story of the cross, Jesus' suffering involves both the rejection of people. It involves a false trial where people unjustly accused him and said things that weren't true about him just so they could get the accomplished goal of having him executed. He stood in front of the tribunal with this guy named Pilate, the Roman governor, where the entire culture said, you know, he said, you can have one of two people. You can have Jesus or Barabbas released to you. And they chose a murderer to be released to kill Jesus. And he had to stand there and take it. And he did it with his mouth shut. He never defended his own rights. He never stood up and said, what's going on here is wrong. He just took it. But even deeper than that, and this is where the passage is trying to get at, there was something much greater where it says, he has borne our griefs, he has carried our sorrows, we esteemed him stricken and smitten by God and afflicted. He was wounded for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. All of us like sheep have gone astray and we have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. See, what's going on in this passage is Isaiah's bringing in all these areas of life. And he's saying, listen, every little part of this, while it's beautiful, it's broken. And we want to run to the beauty of things. And so we do all kinds of stuff where we run to the beauty of our lives. Things like, you know, building up our own bodies. And we try to make our bodies strong. But then we exercise, and just a little bitty microscopic blip, H1N1, cancer, just absolutely destroys what many of us put our hope in. Or we run to things like relationships. We think relationships will work, but in every human relationship, for some weird reason, there is in the midst of that relationship the fact that there's deep brokenness, and the closest relationships we can have are also the relationships that have the potential to bring the greatest pain and hurt, and often do. And religion, we run to religion, and all of a sudden religion is twisted and messed up, and people are like that. Or we run to nature, and we stand, you know, we sell our house and we move to Florida thinking, man, if I just lived on the beach, everything would be fine, and then a hurricane hits and destroys it all. And in every corner, at every place, there is this fact that it's broken and twisted. But what goes on and what is real about this is that every place where the world is twisted, there is a deeper issue. The twistedness here is a reflection of the fact that our relationship with our Creator is broken and twisted. And what God was doing by allowing suffering and evil in the world was to put this earthly reminder that there is a big problem that has to be fixed. And it's not with us in nature. It's not with us in our bodies. It's not with us in our relationships. Those things are not the problem. The problem is that there is a cutoff between us and God. And so Jesus comes, and on the cross, what he does is he bore your pain. I mean, what Jesus suffered, it's actually biblically, it's the cumulative suffering of all of creation, all of us for all of time was laid on him. And from the cross, Jesus cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Meaning this beautiful relationship between God the Father and God the Son for a moment was broken, and he literally suffered hell for us. And he suffered for us. He took on the brokenness of this world, and he did that in our place. And in the incarnation, there's this beautiful truth that when I go and I look around and I feel the suffering, my heart cries out, there's something wrong, and we're right. But the something that is really wrong is not that my body's not functioning. That's just a byproduct of me and God are not functioning. And in Jesus' suffering, he has literally paid the price and bought redemption and given us access back to knowing God. And so he suffered for us. But the second thing that we find in this passage and all throughout the Bible is not just that he suffered for us, but Jesus suffers with us. That he entered into this realm and his suffering was literally part of the current situation. And that our suffering here, we feel like there's no purpose, no meaning, and how do we make sense of it? And what the Bible teaches is that Jesus enters in and he does it with us. And here's one of the cool, really cool things about this entire passage. Isaiah chapter 53. Here's the context, okay? Isaiah writes about 700 years before Jesus, okay? So Jesus is going to show up 700 years later. And Isaiah is writing to the Hebrew people, the Jewish people, at a time where they were experiencing some hardship in life, but it wasn't all bad. They still had prophets going around going, God's going to get us out of everything. He's going to give us health and wealth. Does it sound like anything today? If you just believe God, everything's going to be perfect. And Isaiah is one of the first prophets to go, nope, our relationship with God is really broken. It's really twisted. We need to repent, but we're not going to do it. And in the near future, 100 years from now, basically, God is going to deal with us. Judgment is coming. And Isaiah begins to say this, okay? And then what happens, he writes 39 chapters of, we've got to get this right. We got to get back with God, but it's not going to happen. We are too into ourselves. And in chapter 40, God gives him this crazy ability to write to people who will live 100 years from when he lived, okay? This portion is part of that, where he writes to people 100 years, but the situation in 100 years is that the people who are Israel are going to be conquered by this nation, Babylon, and they're going to be ripped from their homes and taken really far away to a culture that's not their own. They're going to lose everything, and they're going to live not really as slaves, but as just workers in a culture, and they're going to be just totally, I mean, it's going to be a point in their history where everybody is going to have one question, and the question is going to be the same question that every person on that video asked, which is the question, what? Why? Why, God, why? And what Isaiah does is 100 years before it happens, he begins to answer the question, and to make it real simple, there's chapter 40 through chapter, some say 66, the whole rest of the book. Others will break it down a little more, say that Isaiah is answering the big question that people in the future are going to have, which is why. And in Isaiah chapter 40, the answer is that God is sovereign. There's nothing outside of his control, that even the kings and the nations on this planet are well within his control, that he turns them like water in his hand. He can make it go wherever he wants to. God is God. But in chapter 53, he begins to write and say, but even though God is sovereign, he's not distant. And he enters into our suffering with us. And he writes this passage that we read, and we're like, I see in this Jesus. It's very clear, the suffering of Jesus. But here's an interesting thing. And if you're reading it, you know, and you're kind of somebody who understands language in English, you know, even in English, you see how it's written. Is this written in past tense or present tense or future tense? All of chapter 53 is written like a newspaper account of something that has already happened. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed in our iniquities. The chastisement was upon. You see that? Weird. What's going on? Why doesn't he say he will be? Why isn't this projection out of someday? And the answer, theologically, biblically, the answer that helps us is that the solution to our need was there before a need was. Suffering is not easy. And these people are about to go through it. But for them, even though Jesus' coming was a distant reality that's going to happen 700 years later, in the economy of God, God has already provided the solution. And we hit these times where we feel like we're going through it alone. And while this boggles my mind, my just offering to you is that before you get there, God was there in the person of Christ. And he has already suffered with you in this. His suffering is your suffering. He enters in. It is not, the story of Christianity is not a message of a distant God who's throwing answers at us. The story of Christianity is the God who steps in and walks through it with us. And you start reading the accounts in the Bible and outside the Bible of these people who knew Jesus. And what happens is the presence of Jesus is more real than just the horrific, crazy things they go through. You read these stories of people who are getting burned at the stake, and while they're burning, and they literally were nailed to a piece of wood and set on fire. And while the fire's engulfing them, they're singing praises. And you know, my life, listen, I'm gonna be honest, my suffering personally has been minimal. I've seen some people in my life go through, you know, great brokenness. And we've had points where it was, but the truth of the matter is, I look at those stories, I just don't have a category for it. But the promise is I never go through it alone. The resource, one of the great resources is that first, Christ suffered for us. He took on really the punishment that I deserve. But then when I go through it, Christ walks through it with me. We don't have, as Hebrews calls it, a high priest who doesn't sympathize with us. But we have a high priest who's right in the middle of it, who knows what it feels like to be broken, despised, rejected, crushed, all this kind of stuff. And in the middle of it, the greatest resource here is the presence of God. That God has stepped in. And that even in the midst of it, I may not make sense of it, but yes, we can find that God has a purpose. In verse 10, it says that it was the will of the Lord to crush him. I mean, it's hard. But the outcome is that there's beauty in what happened because of Jesus. And in the cross, we have a framework to look at the suffering we go through and go, I may not understand it, but at the end, God will accomplish his purpose and he will walk through it with me. We never go alone. And so what happens for the follower of Jesus that becomes this person who lives through brokenness and suffering is that the outcome is that we become these champions, these trumpets, this fanfare of the beauty of the gospel. My mother-in-law, 10 years, just one event after another of brokenness, suffering, bad reports from doctors, her health just spiraled out of control. And I remember sitting with her one day, she raised the same question, why? And I had to tell her, I don't know. But I do know this. You can suffer well to the glory of God, and you'll never be left alone. And as you suffer well for the glory of God, your grandchildren are watching you. And they will learn the greatness of God more in your suffering than they will in all our good times. And she did. She suffered well. She never went it alone. And she would testify that. And so this is what God does in the midst of it. And the last thing I will tell you, the last resource out of here is not just that Jesus suffered for us and that Jesus suffers with us, but the last thing is that Jesus' suffering gives hope to us. It leaves us with hope. And there's this beautiful passage, it ends in chapter 53, verse 12, where he says, therefore I will divide him a portion with many, And he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul to death, and he was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he bore the sin of men, and he makes intercession for the transgressors. And this is basically what's being said here. It's saying at the end of this story, there is a victory. And what happens, the language here is the language of a conquering general who goes in and is victorious over in a war. And then when he's victorious in a war, he gets the spoils, okay? So he goes in and he conquers another nation, and that nation has all these natural resources and all this other stuff that's out there. And he gathers all those things and he brings them back, and they are his spoils. But what he does, look at what he says in verse 12 again. It says, I will divide him a portion with the many, and he will divide the spoil with the strong. Meaning, he will experience victory, but then he will come share that with his people. And this is the beauty of the story. We go through suffering, we encounter brokenness, and then we look to the cross and we see that Jesus suffered for us, and he suffered with us, but that's not the end. That after his suffering, there is the resurrection, that Jesus is victorious. He wins. That this death story, this suffering, does not consign Jesus to just some weird example of how to go through hardship. That the story ends with everything that held him back and left, that is twisted about the world. Jesus is victorious, and he's alive, and he physically resurrects, and he blows the doors off the whole thing. And he's victorious. He has won the battle over that which breaks us. And he divides the spoils. With who? You and me, if we trust him, if we know him, if we're his people. What is that? Some of that's here. But even more so, there is this hope in the midst of it that this world is not all there is. See, there's, you know, I've kind of been going through this. In suffering, you know, we have this issue where whenever we suffer, something goes off on the inside of and go, this place is not the way it should be. And we have this other voice that goes off in suffering that we feel alone and abandoned. But the other voice that's going off is, there's got to be something outside of this that's better. And the story of the gospel is that we have in Christ the person who has gone through it and come back and is victorious, and he has promised us he's going to spread the spoils. He's going to share the victory. His victory is ours. And this is why Jesus looks at his disciples. He says, hang in there, stay strong, because in my Father's house there's many rooms, and I'm going to prepare a place for you, and if I go to prepare a place for you, one day I'm going to come back and take you with me. Christianity gives us not just hope or a way to deal with the brokenness now, but it gives us a time frame to go, this is short. It feels like eternity when I'm in pain. But this isn't it. And that's the beauty of the incarnation. And while we may go through things where we throw up the question, why? And God may not answer a good linear answer for us. We know that Christ has taken this for us, that he steps into it with us, and he offers us hope that this isn't it. And it's the only answer. I actually think it's the only answer to the question, why does suffering exist? And I just want to encourage you, wherever you're at, deal with that. Interact with it. Live for the gospel, because following Jesus and trusting Jesus gives beauty and hope in the midst of it. So two quick applications to this, okay? That if you're a follower of Jesus, this is the application for how do we deal with evil and suffering. And the first is that throughout the Bible, cover to cover, the response to brokenness and suffering in our life is this weird, I mean, it's not natural, but it's to rejoice. James chapter 1 says, consider it all joy, my brothers, when you encounter various trials, multicolored, diverse trials, because the testing of your faith produces endurance. Count it joy. Paul says in his epistles, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say rejoice. You start reading the Psalms and you start reading through all the passages of the Bible where people are speaking into the lives of brokenness, hurting, people who are suffering, and the cry every time is that we need to learn how to say, God, I praise you and I find my joy in you. Even though life hurts, you are good and I will rejoice. My heart is settled on joy. That's hard. But what happens? The reason this is so important, wherever you are, whoever you are, whatever you're going through, to shift your thinking from woe is me to you are good and I will praise you and rejoice, is because the act of rejoicing, and I'm not talking about, it's not I'm going to be fake. Oh God, I'm happy. No. It's that, God, I'm miserable, but I find my joy in you. What happens when I begin to reorient my thought in that direction, it allows me to broaden my view of my hurt. Because what happens when you're just totally, it's hard? We become very self-absorbed and consumed by the moment. And what rejoicing does is it allows us to begin to see my hurt and my brokenness from God's perspective and from an eternal perspective, okay? And so my challenge to you is to begin to figure out what it looks like to stop in your prayers and say, God, I don't understand. I'm asking you why. But a big deep breath and say, but I will rejoice in you. And the second thing is that as the people of God, if for those of us who are followers of Jesus, the incarnation of Jesus, the fact that he stepped out of heaven, stepped out of his situation into flesh and entered our suffering with us and for us, means that the gospel in us ought to cause us to be the same type of people. Which means that we have got to quit as the people of God looking at the suffering of the world around us with a complacent, deal with it yourself attitude. And we've got to quit using and seeing suffering as, I'm trying to figure out how to even phrase this. Well, you're getting that because of who you are. Now, I'm not denying the reality of sin. All of us suffer, and I told you the suffering is in the world because of sinfulness. But God's response is not to keep a distance and go, yeah, but your problems are your own, deal with it. And this, I think, is often the way Christianity has responded. And I'll give you the clearest example that'll be just real obvious is the AIDS epidemic. What we do with AIDS is we go, well, people who get it normally deserve it, right? An incarnational gospel, figuring out what Isaiah 53 really means is, am I willing to go suffer for that person, with that person, to offer that person hope, whether or not they receive it or not? Am I willing to take on the pain and brokenness of the world around me? Because that is how Jesus lived his life and how he lives his life in me. We as a church have to figure out who's suffering in Eureka and how do we step into their lives and be incarnations of the glory of God for them. That is how the gospel ought to affect us. I don't know how it looks every single day, but if we just say our attitude about suffering is what I do when I'm flipping through the TV, that instead of stopping and seeing the brokenness, I'm turning over and watching Seinfeld, we're missing the gospel and how it fleshes in our lives. And we have always got to be a people who constantly looks at ourselves and figures out what that looks like. To not be immune, but to be involved in the brokenness in our world. Okay. We decided to do communion this morning. I actually wasn't on any calendar or any schedule. But the whole point was, we got to come to Jesus. We have got to see the blood spilled and the body broken as God's resource for any suffering we go through. And so we're doing communion this morning where God... where Jesus said, I did this for you. Remember me. And the band's going to come out. We're going to sing. And as we sing, just take a moment, reflect on Isaiah 53, what the text is telling us about what Jesus did for us. And then come celebrate communion as Jesus answer his solution to the brokenness in the world, that he didn't stay outside and just point directions. He stepped in and became for us who he is. After communion, after we do a song, I'll come back and we'll see if we had any questions that we can interact with as well. Okay, so I'm going to pray. Then you can stand. We'll sing. You come do communion. We have our offering baskets here. If you're a member of Genesis, this will be your time to worship through that as well. Lord, we love you and we praise you and thank you that in Jesus you give us the resources to deal with suffering. We just ask you to speak in our lives today. In your name I pray. Amen.